It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where we have cloudy skies, west winds at 6 miles per hour at the airport, where they have 10 miles of visibility, and the Weather Service is calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day and mostly sunny skies for tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, we check back in on Western Alaska 1 year after Murbach. The Center for Biological Diversity is suing the federal government over a new marine highway in Alaska. And a high number of fatal crashes on Kenai Peninsula highways have four things in common. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Screenwriters and major studios now have a tentative agreement to end a nearly five-month-old strike that virtually paralyzed Hollywood. More than 11,000 members of the Writers Guild of America still have to sign off on it. Also, tens of thousands of film and television actors with SAG-AFTRA are still on strike, all fighting for higher pay, benefits, and stronger job protections in an industry that's increasingly invested in AI. Some snacks for striking auto workers near Chicago this morning, courtesy of Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. The political attention's about to heat up this week when President Biden joins workers on the picket lines in Detroit tomorrow, and a day later, former President Donald Trump follows suit. Thousands of United Auto Workers members went on strike against General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis 10 days ago for higher pay, shorter work weeks, and stronger job protections. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports a separate auto workers union in Canada has approved a deal with Ford, but it's not yet clear how that might play into U.S. talks.
Members of Unifor, the Canadian auto workers union, struck a deal without striking. Unifor says production workers in Canada will now make 35% more than equivalent workers in the U.S. Ford only employs about 5,600 union workers in Canada. It has 10 times that many UAW workers in the States. The UAW continues to negotiate with Ford, GM, and Stellantis. It seems closer to a deal with Ford, but the company's last update indicated significant gaps remain between the two sides. Workers are trying to get back some benefits they gave up about 15 years ago. The companies say the union's demands would make it impossible to compete with non-union rivals. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Democrat New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez is rebuffing calls to resign after being indicted on federal bribery charges. Charles Lane of member station WNYC reports after Menendez addressed reporters without taking questions this morning.
Menendez is accused of giving sensitive information to Egypt and trying to interfere with criminal cases. Federal prosecutors say businessmen bribed him with gold bars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and a luxury car. He read from a prepared statement without addressing most of the accusations, but said he kept large amounts of cash in his home for emergencies.
This will be the biggest fight yet, but as I have stated throughout this whole process, I firmly believe that when all the facts are presented, not only will I be exonerated, but I still will be the New Jersey's senior senator.
Menendez didn't say if he'll run for re-election in 2024. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane in New Jersey.
U.S. stocks end the day higher, with the Dow closing up 43 points at 34,006. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. 1 year ago, much of western Alaska was under flood and storm warnings as Typhoon Murbach swept into the Bering Sea. More than 1,300 miles of coastline was hit, and more than 35 remote communities. 1 year after the storm, residents look back on the havoc that struck the state. KNOM's Ava White has the story.
Typhoon Murbach hit the state of Alaska September 17, 2022. For many, a year's worth of food was lost, fishing gear broken, and subsistence camps that had been passed down through generations destroyed. Brian Metzger is the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. He says the storm was historic for many reasons.
The fact that this happened in September, we didn't have the, any sea ice to kind of dampen the waves from the coastal flooding.
Metzger says remnants of typhoons enter the Bering Sea every year, even in years when the National Weather Service doesn't expect storms in the region. When Murbach hit last year, forecasters warned that seas could rise up to 54 feet and winds could reach up to 86 miles an hour along affected shorelines. The city of Nome experienced peak winds of over 70 miles an hour. Metzger said the best way to prepare for a typhoon is for communities to install long-term infrastructure solutions, such as seawalls made of large rocks or concrete, but they're costly and they're not realistic for all communities.
So it's not always practical to move every possible thing, but moving things of value, cars, snow machines, four-wheelers, small boats, inland.
The communities of Hooper Bay, Scammon Bay, Gullivan, Newtok, and Nome were hardest hit. Sierra Smith lives in Gullivan. She recalls seeing her neighbor's house for the first time after the storm.
Because the door got blown open by the waves, and their house was filled with like 3 feet of sand, and all their shoes were buried under it. And they were cold, and they were scared.
Smith's family stayed the night at the school in the fear that the storm would get worse. She said her son is particular about what he eats, and she had to find a way to feed him.
And so we ended up taking a steel trash can, and we found some blocks and paper towels and some rubbing alcohol and a beaker in the science classroom, and we took them out on the back steps, and we'd light a little fire, heat up his milk, pour it in his bottle, smother the fire, go inside and feed him several times during the day.
Amanda Noyakuk of Nome lost her grandparents' cabin. The cabin, once located on Belmont Street in Nome, was swept away into the Snake River during the storm. The morning that the storm hit, Noyakuk began receiving masses of photos before she arrived on the scene.
Because I was in out and about, and people that were at Belmont, there were people sharing photos, and so I was getting like screenshots of them, and that's how I found out. And it wasn't until when it got bright out that we went to go and look at the house, and there was nothing we could do about it because it was floating in the river and it was pushed up against the Snake River Bridge.
Luckily, there was nobody living in the house at the time. The home was being used to store sentimental belongings.
I seen a lot of my baby clothes, a lot of my old toys, my sister's old toys, old photographs.
Barbara Alcron has a camp at mile 29.5 on the Nome Council Road. She said that the aftermath of the storm is still heartbreaking 1 year later, and that the city doesn't look the same since.
We can't even go down to the beach area. We have to jump down the beach now.
Alcon's family is working on the rebuilding of the cabin, but is waiting for shipments of material to arrive from Anchorage. She's hoping to finish the rebuild by the time the snow falls. And as the rebuilding takes place, she still enjoys her mornings at camp.
We're so happy right there because it's so quiet. You get up early in the morning, you sit there, have a cup of coffee, sit out there and look at the sunrise.
After the typhoon, FEMA used high watermarking data to prioritize disaster relief funding and validate flood models. The data was incorporated into an interactive tool from the federal government that allows users to see where damage from previous floods occurred. It's the first data from the Alaska coastline to ever be used in the viewer. For KNOM, I'm Ava White.
The Center for Biological Diversity intends to sue the federal government over a new marine highway in Alaska. The environmental group says the U.S. Maritime Administration, which designated the new highway, is violating the Endangered Species Act. As KUCV's Maggie Nelson reports, the center believes the highway could pose a threat to several protected species, including humpback and North Pacific right whales.
Jared Margolis is a senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. He says MARAD should have consulted with federal environmental agencies to ensure that certain species and their habitats wouldn't be threatened by the new marine highway.
The regulators designated this new marine highway route, which goes right through critical habitat for the North Pacific right whale, which is a highly endangered species that's susceptible to ship strikes, without giving any consideration to what that means for the species in terms of targeting this area for increased vessel traffic.
MARAD did not respond to requests for comment. The Maritime Agency designated the new highway, called M11, in mid-August. It will add more than 6,500 miles to Alaska's marine highway system. It includes waterways in the Bering Sea, Bristol Bay, and the Arctic Ocean, and it covers ports from the Aleutians up to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and around the North Slope. The infrastructure for the highway is not yet in place, but the designation opens federal funding channels. According to the Center for Biological Diversity, protected species such as fin whales, humpback whales, polar bears, and bearded seals live and migrate along the route. Margolis says it also puts the critically endangered North Pacific right whale at risk.
With species like the North Pacific right whale, the death of even one mother or calf could really impact the continued existence of this species. So these are animals that have been on this planet for quite a long time, and we're driving them to the edge.
He says these species are already struggling to survive as climate change threatens their habitats.
This is sort of compounding that impact by saying, all right, we're going to target this area for increased vessel traffic. We're going to give potentially millions of dollars to private companies and ports to do things to increase their ability to put boats on the water.
More vessels, he says, mean more ship strikes and more pollution from things like fuel and oil spills. Margolis says the center isn't aiming to completely shut down the route. They just want some checks and balances, some policy in place to protect these vulnerable populations.
Where do we want to see vessel traffic? How do we want to see it develop? What do we need to put in place, safeguards, to ensure that vessels are not harming species? And how do we collect data on impacts to species under this program so that there isn't death by a thousand small cuts?
He says the Endangered Species Act requires agencies to ask those kinds of questions, to consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Services before designating new marine highways. What would be the outcome? In Margolis's opinion, it should result in program-wide criteria and safeguards for tracking and minimizing harmful impacts. The center is giving the U.S. Maritime Administration a deadline, 60 days to make changes, or they'll launch a lawsuit. He says he's hopeful MARAD will be responsive. Reporting for KUCB, I'm Maggie Nelson.
There are more volcanoes in Alaska than in any other state, and the Alaska Volcano Observatory keeps an eye on them. The organization measures seismic and infrasound activity on more than 20 volcanoes, and they watch for visual signs like ash clouds using satellites and webcams. Now, scientists have a new technology to measure volcanic activity, drones, by attaching gas detectors to the unmanned aircraft and flying them over volcanic events, scientists can measure output to smell if a volcano's activity is changing. In August, KUCV's Andy Lusk sat down with Christopher Kern from the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
Okay, wonderful. Well, it's great to have you in the studio. Thank you all for coming out today. Why are you here? What brings you to Unalaska Island?
We are out here to take some measurements of volcanic gases and photogrammetry measurements of the summit of Makushin Volcano. And the new thing about what we're doing this time around, and we've done it once before 2 years ago, is that we're trying to do this without the use of a helicopter or a fixed-wing aircraft. We are doing it solely reliant on a drone.
Well, I wanted to know a little bit, in the simplest terms, what kind of tech you're using and what you've brought out here with you to the island.
Sure, yeah. So the The drones that we're using for this mission, the S2, we originally developed with a partnership with NASA as a new aircraft to start doing a lot of their Earth science missions.
Right.
And, you know, originally we were doing some calibration of satellites that they have. You know, we'd fly under the satellite, get closer in data, and then compare what the satellite saw and let them validate and correct those.
Right.
But as time went on, we got more and more requests to do missions. You know, I would call this one sort of the pinnacle one in terms of just challenges and right. what we're doing. And there's really not like one secret sauce, but it's just a lot of just like good engineering, iteration, improvements. Because, you know, the goal is to fly in these kind of environments. And, you know, this specific aircraft has, or this design has flown in, you know, Greenland. It's flown in really hot weather. It's flown over volcanoes in the jungles of Costa Rica. It's flown really high altitudes.
Because you're launching right from the airstrip on the airport.
Yeah, we've been launching directly from the airport here in Dutch Harbor. The idea here is really to develop a technology that can be used from a safe distance. In the event of an erupting volcano.
Right.
And so that means at least 10 miles, I would say.
Right.
One of the reasons why we picked McCutcheon, though, is we didn't have to take a boat to get to it.
When you're mapping something like McCutcheon, how long does that entire process take?
I would say for photogrammetry, you know, you break it down into two parts. One part is the acquisition of the data, so basically photos, and for that you have to ensure that your photos have enough overlap. So basically you're flying back and forth, kind of like mowing the lawn over the summit of the volcano.
Yeah.
And taking hundreds, I would say, of photographs. And then you're very right in that the computer does a lot of heavy lifting on the analysis side. Right. And that, in fact, the photogrammetric analyses are some of the most computationally expensive, we say. So the ones that require the most computer power, basically, to do. So they basically you feed the images into a software that then can take anywhere from minutes to several hours.
Right.
To process those and convert them into what we're after, which is the digital elevation model.
Okay.
And those models, depending on the resolution of the cameras and the altitude at which the aircraft flies above the ground, tend to have precisions, you know, on the order of centimeters, let's say.
Right.
So they're very, very accurate.
Well, how do you deal with the issue of snow, given that we're in Alaska and that seems like a pretty common problem?
So we're focusing a lot on areas that are snow-free, and there are actually quite a few snow-free areas also.
Right.
And those are there because there are hot gas emissions.
Right.
So some of the craters don't have snow in them, and so we're looking at things like whether those craters are changing their shape. Maybe the level of the lake that's in the largest of the summit craters. Those are things that actually could be indicative of changing activity of the volcano itself. Okay. And then in terms of the gas measurements that we're also making, we're trying to measure two things. We're trying to measure the composition of the gases that are emitted and the emission rate, so how much gas per hour or day.
Right.
And both of those are very indicative of processes that are occurring within the volcano itself.
Very last question. When will the results of your study be published, and when can the public know what you found out here?
It'll be another couple of weeks, I would say, before these results are made public, but they will be released most likely as a USGS data release. There will be a little bit of interpretation there as well, and they'll be posted online at the USGS data portal, which is called Science Base.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for coming in. I really do appreciate your time this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was KUCB's Andy Lusk talking to Christoph Kern from the Alaska Volcano Observatory. A large part of the Denali Park Road was closed on Saturday so scientists could collar bears. The big landslide that has closed much of the road in Denali National Park and Preserve could be changing the way animals live in the park. so park biologists will be radio-collaring grizzly bears this fall as part of a project to assess the impacts of park road traffic on the animals. KUAC's Robin has this report.
The Pretty Rocks landslide is halfway along the park's 92-mile road. The exposed multicolored slope has been slipping down slowly over time, but accelerated warming caused big movements and the roadbed became dangerous. The park closed the road at Pretty Rocks in August 2021. Since that time, only hikers and bicyclists have accessed the western 50 miles of the road.
The west end of the park road right now is getting no traffic at all.
That's Pat Owen, a park wildlife biologist. She wants to know if bears and other animals are changing their behavior without cars and the big buses of tourists.
What we're trying to do is to collar some bears, to look at their movements and behavior, what they're doing out there in the absence of traffic.
This fall, park staff will be catching grizzly bears and putting radio collars on them before they go into hibernation. Owen doesn't want any backcountry users to be surprised. No pedestrians, bicyclists, or backpackers will be allowed in the closed area while wildlife biologists are looking for bears from helicopters.
Fingers crossed the weather will be with us. If we get a little snow, so much the better. It makes it easier to see bears.
Owen says they were able to collar some bears in June in the closed area, and already their behavior is notable.
All the bears that we've collared so far, bears initially that were near the road corridor, most of them are staying fairly close to the road. It's been pretty interesting to see. There are clumps of locations that are not all that far from where we initially caught those bears.
The National Park Service has contracted to build a suspension bridge over the unstable Pretty Rocks landslide that will allow tour buses to get to the western side of the park. Owen says the data in this fall's collaring study will build a base for that future.
The plan is to keep these same bears radio collared once the road opens to see how they respond.
The closing and planned reopening of the road provide a unique opportunity to study the before and after on the bears. She anticipates finding there is an effect once traffic resumes.
Are their home ranges going to move away from the road? That's sort of what we would typically speculate because we assume that traffic is a disturbance. But, you know, this will show us, is that really the case?
The bridge is scheduled to be complete and the road reopened in 2026. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
Striking Hollywood writers have a tentative deal. Striking auto workers do not. I'm Nova Safa with a Marketplace Minute. Of Detroit's big three automakers, Ford is furthest along in negotiations with the United Auto Workers Union. But the company says weekend talks failed to close significant gaps. President Biden and former President Trump plan to visit Michigan this week. The Writers Guild of America, meanwhile, has a tentative deal with film, TV, and streaming companies. Striking actors and studios, however, have yet to return to the bargaining table. The Transportation Department is awarding $1.5 billion from the infrastructure law to upgrade rail lines in dozens of states. Among the projects is restoring passenger rail service along part of the Gulf Coast for the first time since Hurricane Katrina. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by Baird. More at BairdDifference.com.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 25th day of September, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 8 o'clock and it will set tonight at 8 o'clock. That will give us 11 hours and 59 minutes. A loss of 4 minutes and 56 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high temperature for this date was 64 degrees set in 1951, and our record low was 29 degrees set in 2015. Currently 49 degrees here in Kodiak. It's kind of cloudy out. Out at the airport, they do have 69% humidity, 6 mile per hour west winds, and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is insistently calling for partly sunny skies today with a high near 54 and northwest winds to 10. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 40, northwest winds 15, gusting to 20. And mostly sunny tomorrow with a high near 56 and northwest winds 15, gusting to 20. Mostly clear overnight for Tuesday night and sunny skies for Wednesday. Let's check in with the brand new one from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 46, date issued 10 a.m. on September 25th. The current commercial salmon fishery in the Intercarlock section of the Southwest Kodiak District will be extended from 6 p.m. Tuesday, September 26th until further notice. Closed waters will be reduced from 6 p.m. Tuesday to September 26th until further notice in the following area. At Carlock Lagoon's exit channel terminus at the ocean shoreline, stream number 255-101. As previously announced, the following areas are open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. The Outer Iakulik, Outer Carlock, Sturgeon and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Central and North Cape sections of the Northwest Kodiak District, the Northeast Kodiak District, the Eastside Kodiak District, Cape Alatak, Alatak Bay, Humpy Deadman, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District, the northwest of Fognak, Raspberry Strait, Duck Bay, Iseuit Bay, Outer Katoy Bay, southwest of Fognak and northeast of Fognak sections of the Fognak District and the Mainland District. Closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the southwest of Fognak section of the Fognak District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 252-105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak district south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area, same as statistical chart, detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations and statistical charts. Harvest strategies and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record-a-phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
We just had a high tide here on the east side. That was at 12:12, about 15 minutes ago, and was only 6.5 feet. Our next low tide here on the east side will be at 5:14 p.m. and only dropped down to 3.4 feet. Over on the west side, you are about to have a high tide at 12:31, just about 5 minutes. That will be an 11.1-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 6:15 p.m. of 4.6 feet. Mariners, here is your weather for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory for tomorrow with north winds to 15, going to northwest 20 tonight. 4-foot seas, building to 6 feet tonight, and for tomorrow, west 25 and seas to 8 feet on the east side. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for tomorrow there as well, with north 15 and seas to 2 feet today, going to variable 10, but becoming northwest 20 after midnight tonight, seas to 3 feet tonight, and west 25 and 4-foot seas in the Shelikof tomorrow. There will be an assembly special meeting tomorrow in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m.
Local elections are coming up on October 3rd. Do you need help deciding who to vote for? KMXT and the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce are sponsoring the 2023 Candidate Forum Monday, September 25th and Wednesday, September 27th at the Borough Assembly Chambers. At 6 p.m. on Monday the 25th will be the City Election Candidate Forums, beginning with the race for City of Kodiak Mayor, followed by the race for 2 seats on the City Council. On Wednesday the 27th are the Borough-wide Candidate Forums, beginning with the School Board candidates at 6 p.m., followed by the candidates for the Borough Assembly. The forums will take place at the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chambers, or you can listen here on KMXT 100.1 FM. Once again, that's 6 p.m. on Monday the 25th for City Mayor and City Council candidates, and Wednesday the 27th for borough-wide candidates. And don't forget to vote. Election Day is October 3rd.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day.
Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.